Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We'd love to tell you we had good and bad martinis today, but we just don't. We have crazy, crazy, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. Jim, we appreciate all of our listeners. We especially want to welcome our listeners who are listening to us from Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport today, because sadly, you're not moving as a result of a power failure that happened on Sunday. Here's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution story. Georgia Power said it believes a failure of its equipment may have started a fire that led to a massive power outage at Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, causing more than 1,000 flight cancellations Sunday, disrupting flights for travelers from around the world. Quote, while evaluation of the incident is ongoing, Georgia Power believes that a piece of Georgia Power switchgear located in an underground electrical facility could have failed and started a fire, Georgia Power said in a written statement overnight after the power was restored. Quote, this fire was located adjacent to redundant circuit cables and switching mechanisms serving the airport, and those cables were damaged, resulting in the outage and loss of redundant service methods. Georgia Power's system responded properly by isolating areas where equipment wasn't operating correctly to ensure safety and minimize damage. No personnel or passengers were in danger at any time. So, Jim, this sounds like Janet Napolitano, the system worked here, because if this is the best case scenario, if this is how it's designed to work, it's a pretty sad state of affairs. You pointed out in the Morning Jolt today that we might even feel better if this had been some sort of cyber attack. But no, this is the way this thing was designed, and this is not instilling confidence at all.
Yeah, and I should kind of give some background that if you, you know, talk to people in the world of cyber warfare, I got a chance to talk to some experts a bunch of years ago. You know, they can give you some real horror stories about air traffic control being taken down and power grids going down for long stretches, all kinds of really frightening scenarios. And so I guess we could take some reassurance in the fact that this was not cyber warfare. This was not ISIS, Al-Qaeda, North Korea, the Chinese, the Russians, anybody like that. So, you know, the good news is, as far as we know, anyone who has the intent to do something terrible like this is not does not appear to be capable of doing so. Having said that, completely random fires can have the exact same effect, which is really not that much reassuring. At least if we, in a case of cyber terrorism, we have somebody to blame and somebody to take all of our frustration out on. In this one, look, I'm not an engineer. I understand, you know, every flight is a miracle. I don't want to pretend I know what I'm doing. But if you have a power system and you want to have a redundant power system, and an airport seems like the sort of structure or building where you'd really want to have a backup power system, you'd think you want to have them, you know, kind of separate, so that one problem doesn't affect the backup system. Because if you build the two things right next to each other, then you're likely to have one problem, you know, that both of them go down at the same time, which is what happened here. And look, we're used to flights and air travel having a bunch of hassles and megillas and aggravation, delayed flights in the works. What really seems like we took this from a routine snafu type circumstances, that the people who were both on the planes and in the airport said that basically it seemed like no one was in charge. No one was really there to help guide them to understand what was happening and what they should do. It sounds like it was very dark inside the terminals. People on the planes were saying they were stuck there. You go through your whole flight, you land at Hartsfield, and all of a sudden you stop. According to one account, they only had five of those little portable stairway trucks that you can use to get people down from a jetliner down to the ground. I can't believe the Hartsfield, which is probably the busiest airport in the country, has only five of those. It's got to be more than that. But it just sounds like a very difficult situation was handled with probably unneeded lack of preparation and confusion and lack of communication, things like that. These people have said that there was zero police presence in the middle of this very tense and disturbing thing. Most people remain calm and didn't panic and things like that. But all in all, this just seems like a bad situation that was made worse, you know, by a lack of organization. And if you're wondering why airlines get so much, you know, this way, I understand you have to deal with people with air rage, but every once in a while, I'd like the airlines to take a look and say, did we do anything to contribute to these people having this air rage?
Three quick takeaways. First of all, major props to Chick-fil-A, who on a Sunday, mind you, apparently came through with thousands upon thousands of meals for folks who were stranded at the airport. Secondly, we obviously hope that this will be sorted out very quickly. It usually takes a day or two for the planes to get where they need to go, so hopefully there's not a lot of people whose Christmas plans are disrupted in a great way. And Jim, obviously it's good that this didn't happen right before the Georgia college football playoff game when people wanted to fly out to the Rose Bowl, because that probably would have led to some pillaging inside the airport if those flights didn't get to go. And finally, and I know you know this, there is one documented case of terrorists taking over the air traffic control system of a major U.S. airport, and that would be in the not greatest Christmas classic, but it's still up there as a pretty good Christmas movie, Die Hard 2.
Indeed, indeed. It was Dulles Airport, and that really is what launched Fred Thompson's political career. That he and John McClain had handled that so well that that clearly said, we should have this guy run for Senate in Tennessee. And the rest is history, as they say.
All right, let's move on to the second crazy martini. And Jim, gosh, it was just a couple of weeks ago, time flies, where Al Franken said he was going to leave the U.S. Senate. He didn't apologize to anyone, didn't take responsibility for anything, but nonetheless said he couldn't really be an effective senator since, what, about two-thirds of his own caucus said he had to leave as a result of the myriad of allegations of him groping or forcibly kissing women. I think we're up to about eight allegations on that now. And so we talked about the fact that he was slow playing the timing of his resignation, even though he announced it. A lot of people thinking he was going to wait to see if Roy Moore actually got elected. And if Roy Moore was going to be seated in the U.S. Senate, he might change his mind and say, well, if this is going to happen, why am I going to go anywhere? But Roy Moore lost. So then the governor of Minnesota nominates the female lieutenant governor of Minnesota to replace Al Franken. And she's already announced she's running to finish the term in 2018. And now we've got a small cadre of Senate Democrats who say, wait, 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 wait. We've maybe rushed the gun on this. Here's the Hill version of the story. At least four senators, including two Democrats, have reportedly said that Senator Al Franken should reconsider his resignation. Senator Joe Manchin told Politico that the deluge of Democrats calling for Franken to resign was, quote, the most hypocritical thing he has ever seen done to a human being. Quote, what they did to Al was atrocious, the Democrats, Manchin added. The most hypocritical thing I've ever seen done to a human being, and then have enough guts to sit on the floor, watch him give his speech, and go over and hug him? That's hypocrisy at the highest level I've ever seen in my life. Made me sick. Patrick Leahy, who had actually called on Franken to resign, now says he regrets doing so and doesn't think that Franken should resign. As for Manchin, he was also on the CNN Morning Show today with Allison Camerata, and they had this exchange.
You don't think he should resign?
I think that Al Franken should go through the process of what he's asked for. Here's the thing about it. I've seen a person that his own caucus has turned on. It just made me sick. It really did. And I've said this. They know how I feel. My caucus know I'm very upset with this process.
So, Jim, are we cynical enough to believe that because Roy Moore lost, the Democrats plan to actually have Al Franken stay in the Senate got botched? Are they having second thoughts? What's going on here? Because right now, the longer Franken stays, he's keeping a woman out of the U.S. Senate.
Basically, he's saying all of his colleagues are a bunch of hypocrites. Now, in this story by Politico, they mentioned two of the senators are Democrats. Patrick Leahy is named as one of them, although he himself declined to comment. I think we acted prematurely, says a third senator, and has expressed regret directly to Franken. It's a really good question coming from MSNBC's Haley Byrd. She says, what changed between the eighth accuser and now? The only thing that really changed was Roy Moore losing the election down in Alabama. Do you think that all those women, you thought they were telling the truth earlier, but now you think they're lying? Or is it just that it doesn't seem that important to you anymore? That all of a sudden, or is it, you know, rapidly gathering evidence that maybe this is going to end up hurting the Democratic Party as much, or maybe even more than the Republican Party? And then all of a sudden, the Me Too movement doesn't seem like a good idea anymore. These are all cynical interpretations, and I think they're all pretty valid based on what we know, based on the articulation we're seeing. Alternately, by the way, I'm wondering if you're Al Franken, do you feel any better if somebody privately comes out and says, you know, I really shouldn't have called for you to resign. I really regret that. And you probably would want that person to say, well, come out and say so. Don't just do it privately. Tell everybody, no, I don't think Al did anything wrong. If nothing else, you know, you give Manchin a little bit of credit for being open about this. But even then, everyone that says, oh, he shouldn't resign, he's being railroaded, we acted too quickly, kind of is implying that all of the accusers are lying, right, Craig? Or that, you know, Al Franken's version of, oh, I just accidentally, my hand brushed their tushy, and that's what, you know, somehow they interpreted that as a grope. And you know, I don't see how you say, oh, I don't think Franken should resign, and say that you take, you know, all instances of sexual harassment seriously, and that you're not accusing these women of being liars. And, you know, look, we live in a world where people do lie. The idea that eight women, a bunch of them are you know, known Democrats and allies and fans of Al Franken right up to that moment of interaction, I just don't buy the idea that they all got together one day and said, hey, let's ruin this guy's reputation for no reason. I think the Democrats are really on the verge of completely blowing up whatever moral authority they had heading into this. And I think it'll be kind of fitting if they suddenly decide, eh, never mind, and he pulls a Larry Craig and you know, decides to not resign.
That'll be fascinating. After announcing. It'll be fascinating. Yeah, Manchin officially is saying that he thinks the process, where it's all about the process needing to play out with the Ethics Committee. The question, though, is, of course, Joe Manchin represents a deep red state. He's up for re-election this year, and to this point, he's not believed to be in any tremendous amount of trouble. So does this change that for him? Although it's worth pointing out, in that same interview with Allison Camerota about 30 seconds later, he says there should not be an investigation of Trump either, which probably helps him in West Virginia. Yeah. So what do you make of this? Does this change his prospects at all?
Manchin will be a fascinating guy to watch over the next year. But my guess is it'll be a lot of one from column A to one from column B, flipping back and forth, trying to placate a you know, culturally conservative demographic in his state that has, you know, used to vote Democratic consistently and now is voting Republican more and more consistently. I do kind of wonder, though, if Al Franken goes through and says, I'm not resigning, I've been railroaded and I'm fighting all this, how does the Tina Smith, the replacement, what, like, does she go back to coat check or something like that? I mean, how do you, the governor says, oh, wait, I was going to appoint her. Never mind. Yeah, you know.
Just a whole domino effect of retracted resignations in Minnesota. That could be fun. Anyway, let's move on to our third crazy martini now, Jim. And let's go to the pages of the New York Times. In the $600 billion annual Defense Department budgets, the $22 million spent on the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program was almost impossible to find, which was exactly how the Pentagon wanted it. For years, the program investigated reports of unidentified flying objects, according to Defense Department officials, interviews with program participants, and records obtained by the New York Times. It was run by a military intelligence official, Luis Elizondo, on the fifth floor of the Pentagon C-ring, deep within the building's maze. The Defense Department has never before acknowledged the existence of the program, which it says shut down in 2012. But its backers say that while the Pentagon ended funding for the effort at the time, the program remains in existence. For the past 5 years, they say, officials with the program have continued to investigate episodes brought to them by service members while also carrying out their other Defense Department duties. That's a lot of fancy language to say they were studying UFOs. They're studying UFOs. And you know who's responsible for that? Three people who are known in Washington to be longtime members of the U.S. Senate, and only one of them still alive. So it's interesting how this story got out there, Jim. Daniel Inouye knew about it. Ted Stevens knew about it. And former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and his explanation for why this program was so secretive: I'm not embarrassed or ashamed or sorry I got this going. I think it's one of the good things I did in my congressional service. I've done something that no one has done before. In Harry Reid's case, that's probably not a good thing. Jim, what do you make of spending $22 million on UFO studies and Harry Reid keeping this secret from everybody except two other senators?
There are two aspects of this story, and a lot of people focused on the first one and not nearly as much focus on the second part. The first part is, you know, this is not Project Blue Book back in the 1960s or something like that, but from 2007 to 2012, the Department of Defense had this small program looking at UFOs. And we can argue about, is this a good idea? Is this something taxpayer money should go towards? Do you come across as some sort of paranoid Fox Mulder type running around screaming about little green men? Or is there enough odd phenomena, unexplained phenomena amongst pilots, amongst those who spend a lot of time up in the air, to make this worthwhile? Is it possible you end up glimpsing something that is in fact experimental craft by hostile powers or something like that? There are non-little green men explanations. Hey, maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth $22 million. whether it's worth keeping secret, I think it reveals a great deal that they didn't want anyone else to know about it. I think it's, you know, if this was all perfectly on the up and up and hunky-dory and a good idea, they would have had no problem defending it. To listen to the guy who was at the center of this program, we're all just a bunch of closed-minded, I don't want to say prudes, close-minded folks who just can't understand the possibility of UFOs, and we're just so short-sighted, and we just don't understand the importance of all this kind of stuff. We are the character who doesn't listen to Jeff Goldblum in a science fiction movie. We're the ones who insist the disaster isn't there, the aliens aren't coming, and all that stuff. Now, in a movie, the Harry Reid secret UFO research program is really important because that's the one that discovers the ray that will destroy the aliens and save us all and all that kind of stuff. In the real world, without any actual aliens, it looks like a giant waste of money. And the bigger and more important aspect to me is that the whole program, all the money for this apparently went to some corporation that is run by a buddy of Harry Reid's. Now, I've heard a lot of people say, look, Jim, in the giant spending of the federal budget, $22 million over 5 years is actually fairly small. This is a drop in the bucket. When it comes to federal waste, this isn't worth getting upset about. So are we just going to have the rule that everybody gets $22 million to give to their buddies? Should we just do that? Should we just make that easier so that they don't have to slip this through secretly in the Defense Department budget? What, the per diems aren't enough? The budgetary control they have isn't enough? I don't think this was a particularly good idea. You and I are a long time on record not being fans of Harry Reid. As somebody said it on Twitter pretty well today, look, it's very important to understand that in politics, those who are on the other side are our opponents. They are not the enemy. We may disagree very strongly. They may have a lot of ideas that we do not agree with, but they are not evil, except for Harry Reid. And I don't know if you necessarily would call the man evil. I do think you would say that he has a certain shamelessness to the way he goes about these things. Because what he's saying here is like, of course I've sponsored this program. I think it's a terrific idea. I'm proud of it. And then in the same breath or in the same interview, he says, oh, of course we didn't tell anyone about it. It was completely secret. Only three people, the whole U.S. Congress knew about it. And that's the way we wanted it. You know, like if it's great, why are you so secret about it? Why are we not allowed to know about it? You know, so kind of insufferable. And Greg, it just seems like good to get one more time in before the year ends. Way to go, Nevada. Way to go.
Does anyone rational miss Harry Reid? I certainly don't. Jim, good start to the week. All crazy. We'll see where it goes from here. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again Tuesday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.